ammunition to Israel while it slaughters civilians every single day, refuses to engage in diplomacy, and yet that wasn't being debated at all. They were arguing about how well they would assist Israel in suppressing the rights of Palestinians and killing them every day. So that's where we are. And I think one point, as we are very clear about the reality of these militarists who are willing to slaughter civilians every day, at the same time, we're facing now a fork in the road. If Donald Trump is elected president, then the left, progressives, even a lot of liberals, will be on the defensive for 4 years. The space to organize will be virtually disappearing, except to try to mitigate the damage that will be done by the administration. Under a Biden or Democratic administration, we have huge problems, terrible foreign policy. What we do have is more space to organize, so we're not just back on our heels. We can organize for real progressive change.
Chris Layman, your final thoughts as you watch this debate, stayed up through the night writing your piece for The Nation, D.C. bureau chief for The Nation magazine.
Well, you know, I would echo virtually everything your other guests have said. And I think Norman underlined a really important point, which is the urgent need to mobilize in a democratic way to change the Democratic, capital D, Democratic ticket. It's a constant refrain, and it's true among Biden supporters that, you know, the soul of the nation and the fate of our democracy are both on the ballot in this cycle. What's paradoxical, though, is we see it in the case of the Gaza war, which is vastly unpopular with the general public. There is a refusal to heed democratic voices within the Biden administration and within the larger Democratic Party. It's important to, you know, pan back a bit and remember that, you know, the reason Democrats nominated Joe Biden in 2020 was that Barack Obama basically went behind the scenes to persuade all of his other primary rivals to fold their hands and, you know, cut deals with Biden to make him the front runner. And that was at a moment when Bernie Sanders was leading in the polls and actually was well ahead of Trump in the polls. So this was a very deliberate decision taken by the party establishment in 2020. And we are, you know, it's like Groundhog Day. We're back in this situation where the Democrats have tried to galvanize mass support behind a candidate who's manifestly not up to the job, and there is a failure to just acknowledge, you know, what Americans saw and heard, you know, loud and clear last night.
And Derek Hamilton, founding director of Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School. You just have 20 seconds.
You know, what is lost and sad in the messaging from this debate is some of the unprecedented interventions that happened during the pandemic, as dramatic as that was, especially in contrast to the Great Recession, where we invested directly in the American people. We should be building upon that.
Derek Hamilton, Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School. Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation. We also want to thank Norman Solomon of the Institute for Public Accuracy, as well as Michelle Goodwin at Georgetown. And finally, Silky Shaw of Detention Watch and Dean Baker. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening. It's Director of Development. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
El apoyo a este programa proviene de los miembros de KBOO y programas preescolares de las escuelas públicas de Portland. Educación y apoyo a las familias. Inscripción ahora para niños serán de 3 a 4 para el 1 de septiembre. Información en pps.net/early learners.
Hey. And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Supreme Court issues a ruling on an Oregon homelessness case.
An ethics complaint against Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has been dropped.
And the Hood River Bridge is closed after a damaging truck crash.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 28th, 2024. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it is constitutional for cities to arrest and ticket unhoused residents sleeping outside, regardless of shelter availability. The case Grants Pass v. Johnson started in Oregon, and the Ninth Circuit Court ruled that a Grants Pass camping ban violated the Eighth Amendment. The Supreme Court overturned that decision on ideological lines, with the six conservative justices voting to overturn. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion stating that the original Grants Pass ordinances that effectively banned sleeping outside with protection from the elements, quote, do not qualify as cruel, end quote. The decision also overturns the Ninth Circuit's 2018 decision in Martin v. Boise, which also used the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual clause to declare that localities cannot institute camping and public rest bans without having enough shelter space for those violating the law. Thus, today's decision makes it legal for local jurisdictions in the Ninth Circuit, generally Western states, to enact camping bans no matter how much shelter is available. These laws are already permitted in states outside the Ninth Circuit. It doesn't mean things will change immediately in Oregon, however. State lawmakers codified the Martin v. Boise decision into state law in ORS 195.530. It states that any local laws on sitting, lying, sleeping, or keeping warm and dry outdoors must be, quote, objectively reasonable. But there may be an appetite to change that in the next session in Salem. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and current city commissioner and mayoral candidate Rene Gonzalez have both indicated that they would like to pursue changes to state law in light of the court's ruling, with Gonzalez explicitly calling on Governor Tina Kotek and state legislators to change the state law.
We are going to dig a little deeper into the Supreme Court decision. And to do that, we have Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, with us. He's been covering the story consistently. First, Jeremiah, what was your reaction to the decision?
Hey, Reed, thanks for having me. This is a really somber day. It's been, you know, kind of hard to work and take it all in at once. But, you know, this is a harmful decision. It's really the logical fallout of poor local policymaking and a Supreme Court that's ruled in favor of the rich and against the poor since the 70s. What kind of occurs to me here is that people who are disproportionately impacted by these same systems, people with disabilities, Indigenous people, Black people, people of color, LGBTQIA plus people are all deeply impacted by most systems. And this decision really does nothing to actually resolve homelessness in a material way. And it's just going to create barriers, you know, on an individual basis for so many people and ultimately making the crisis worse. So people on all sides of this are, you know, likely to be pretty frustrated in a few years by just how much more deeply embedded the homelessness crisis is in our society.
So the Supreme Court made a decision on parts of the case today and sent some parts back to the lower courts. Can you describe what those different pieces are?
Yes. So they reversed part of it, remanded it to the lower court. The initial lawsuit claimed the Grants Pass ordinances violated the cruel and unusual punishments clause. That's what went all the way to the Supreme Court. But it also claimed that it violated the excessive fines clause of the Eighth Amendment. And, you know, this decision didn't explicitly rule out that this may violate the due process clause of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. So people who are fined, told to move, and then arrested don't really have time to challenge their case before they're, you know, summarily punished. So this decision leaves some legal wiggle room for those aspects to be challenged, probably not directly from Grants Pass, but potentially some other jurisdiction.
What kind of change on the ground can we expect to see as a result of this decision in Oregon?
Theoretically, none. The Oregon legislature passed ORS 195-530, and that went into effect in July 2023. So that law requires ordinances regulating survival activities like sitting, lying, sleeping, keeping warm and dry. Those laws must be objectively reasonable with regard to people experiencing homelessness. So here in Oregon, things won't necessarily change on the ground very quickly. I will say, though, I spoke with Cassie Lee, who's a service provider in Grants Pass today. She said many residents there are concerned that, first of all, police can just come in and arrest them now, but also that vigilante groups who harass homeless people might see this as an opportunity to harass people even more. And this court's decision sends that message about how society thinks it can respond to homelessness kind of regardless of those legal protections.
So some officials are hailing this decision as one that will, you know, allow them to address the homelessness crisis definitively. How do you react to that sentiment?
Well, it's a wholly misunderstood thing about homelessness. Arresting people creates barriers to homelessness. So statements from Governor Kotek and the Multnomah County Board Chair, Jessica Vega Peterson, released statements today saying that they're focused on affordable housing, things that actually work to resolve homelessness in the long term. Not a big statement from either of them on, you know, this being a very terrible decision. So Oregon House Republicans, though, Portland City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez and Mayor Wheeler all released statements more or less saying that the legislature should look at changing the law to give cities in their minds the tools that they need to solve this, to solve homelessness. That state law is in place for now, but again, elected officials at all levels are beating the drum to overturn it. And as we've seen with recent moral panics in Oregon, like Measure 110 and the recriminalization of drugs, it remains to be seen if any elected officials are willing to stand up against these public kind of sentiments.
So one of the central questions in this case was whether homelessness could be considered a status or a conduct. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion on this decision today, indicating a new challenge against the court precedent Robinson v. California. What's the significance of that inclusion?
That's a really good question, and I haven't heard a lot of people talking about it, but this seems to be, like, kind of on a broader level, one of the even more horrifying things of an already horrifying decision. This Grants Pass case is rooted in the argument that homelessness is a status, something a person cannot avoid. So Robinson is frequently cited in these Grants Pass v. Johnson documents, and the Ninth Circuit Court affirmed this in Martin v. Boise, that a person cannot be prosecuted for involuntary conduct if it is an unavoidable consequence of their status, such as a person sleeping in public when they lack an alternative. So Thomas's opinion, it has pretty horrifying implications because it could pave the way for laws criminalizing other involuntary statuses. He's saying he thinks that it was wrongly decided. He said in his concurring opinion, rather than let Robinson's erroneous holding linger in the background of our Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, we should dispose of it once and for all. In an appropriate case, the court should certainly correct this error. And to me, that is him. He doesn't have to write a concurring opinion. That sounds like him saying someone somewhere should challenge Robinson.
Jeremiah, thank you so much for coming to speak with us this evening.
Thanks so much for having me, Reed.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with us about the Supreme Court decision in the case Grants Pass v. Johnson that came down today.
A new report from the group Inseparable examines how states performed in implementing the national 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. It highlights Oregon's efforts at suicide prevention among young people. Eric Tegadoff has this report.
The report examines the rollout of the 988 mental health crisis line in each state. It finds Oregon has more work to do. The national three-digit 988 suicide and crisis lifeline is nearing its second anniversary. While the report says progress is needed, it does highlight a bright spot in the state, Oregon's youth line. The service offers crisis support from teens to teens from 4 to 10 p.m. Oregon Health Authority's Youth Suicide Prevention Policy Coordinator Jill Baker says this is a developmentally important intervention strategy.
There's lots of young people who volunteer at Youthline. These are young people who have either an interest in mental health or an interest in supporting other youth, or young people who have lived experience with mental health challenges or suicide themselves.
Baker says the addition of texting with the 988 crisis line has also been a game changer for young people in suicide prevention. Angela Kimball with Inseparable says one issue states need to solve is finances, including how the program is funded and ensuring services are available to everyone regardless of their health insurance status.
That means that a system has to be built to not just be dependent on Medicaid, for example. And that means that legislatures actually need to take the step to ensure that there are other funding sources besides Medicaid.
Baker says the crisis line is important, but it's just one part of suicide prevention.
Anything that increases the ability for a young person to feel a sense of connection or belonging to their culture, to their community, to other people, to nature, all of those things increase a young person's protection against suicide.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Industries are around the table, community groups.
The State Ethics Commission has dismissed complaints against Governor Tina Kotek. The complaints related to a government role the governor gave to her spouse, First Lady Amy Kotek Wilson. In a 4-4 vote, the commission voted not to pursue an investigation into potential violations of anti-nepotism laws. The vote fell along party lines. Commission rules require at least 5 yay votes to open a formal investigation. A preliminary investigation started after several top aides resigned from the governor's staff, citing concerns over Kotek Wilson's involvement in policy and personnel decisions within the governor's office. Ethics Commission Chair Sean Lindsay argued that those staffers should have been interviewed prior to dismissing complaints against the governor. Suzanne Myers, the commission director, said that after reviewing emails and media reports, she found no legal basis for moving forward with the formal investigation. The governor's office released a statement saying that she was grateful for the commission's deliberations, adding that, quote, "The First Lady is a volunteer and public official with relevant professional experience that can provide tremendous value in furthering the governor's priorities," end quote.
A diverse coalition of groups in Oregon is advocating for the restoration of the Climate Protection Program as the state works to reestablish it. The Climate Mitigation Program was invalidated in 2023 after a judge ruled the Department of Environmental Quality did not fully comply with the rulemaking process. The agency is in the process of reinstating it, completing its third and final rulemaking advisory committee meeting this week. Oregon Director of Climate Solutions Meredith Connolly says while it's disappointing the program was struck down, DEQ has been diligent in the restoration process.
Regulated industries are around the table, community groups, businesses, climate groups, public interest sector. And they actually have been asking the question, well, it was in effect for a few years. What was working? Where could we make improvements? And so that's been the main focus of this rulemaking process.
Connolly says the state won't be able to meet its clean energy goals without the plan, which aims to reduce emissions by 90% by 2050. Nearly 50 environmental, economic, and business groups and indigenous communities are part of the Coalition for Climate and Economic Justice. DEQ is expected to publish a notice of proposed rulemaking in July. Tim Miller is head of the Oregon Business for Climate and says the agency has made some tweaks that help large, energy-intensive businesses stay competitive with businesses in other states. He says there are a lot of upsides for businesses from Climate Protection Program, including its long planning horizon.
The Climate Protection Program creates a bunch of business opportunities because folks are going to need to invest in their homes and their businesses and their buildings and in renewable energy and in transportation efficiency. Those are all job creation investments.
Meredith Connolly says one of the most important parts of the program is the Community Climate Investments Fund. She says that emitters in the state can invest in this program, which supports communities that are on the front lines of climate change.
We need to both be having the biggest polluters be responsible for reducing their pollution, but also investing in the solutions that help communities adapt and become more resilient and be able to afford clean energy solutions.
That was Meredith Connolly, the Oregon Director of Climate Solutions.
The Hood River Bridge is closed to all traffic. This after a semi-truck crash on Thursday caused damage to structural beams on the bridge. According to reports, the semi-truck was towing an excavator and failed to properly lower the arm. The extended arm proceeded to cut through several lateral braces on the bridge. The century-old bridge is the only river crossing for 20 miles east and west, and is extremely narrow by modern standards. There have been previous instances of passing trucks wedging one another against the guardrails on either side of the bridge. The Port of Hood River Commission will convene an emergency public meeting on Sunday at 10 a.m. Agenda items will include a report from HDR Engineering on the potential of reopening the interstate bridge. HDR will also discuss a proposed schedule for necessary repairs. The decision whether to reopen the bridge to vehicular traffic will be made following the engineering report. A $520 million project is already underway to replace the Hood River Bridge, and construction was scheduled to begin in early 2026. Drivers crossing the Willamette River will, for the time being, need a detour either west over the Bridge of the Gods in Cascade Locks or east over the Dalles Bridge.
In similar news, Interstate 5 will be closed in southwest Portland starting Friday evening through early Monday morning. The four-mile closure is between exits 294 and 297, and detours will take drivers out to I-205 and onto Highways 26 and 217. Southwest Barber Boulevard will be open to local traffic. Construction crews will be rebuilding a bridge deck that goes over southwest 26th Avenue. They've spent the past year constructing the underside of the bridge to bring it up to modern earthquake standards. Crews will spend the closure constructing the bridge deck on top. The Oregon Department of Transportation says closing the interstate for one weekend for construction will save around $5 million and 6 months of construction times. The closure starts at 9 p.m. tonight and lasts through Monday at 5 a.m.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy with a high of 77. Today in history, in 1969, the Stonewall Riots begin in New York City, marking the start of the gay rights movement. The uprising was in reaction to a police raid of the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York City. And our quote of the day is from French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, born this day in 1712. He said, quote, "A country cannot subsist well without liberty, nor liberty without virtue."
The U.S. Supreme Court dismissed a case on Thursday brought by the state of Idaho that would have restricted abortion even in emergency situations. The justices said they were dismissing an appeal by the state of Idaho, reestablishing a lower court decision allowing hospitals to perform abortions in emergency cases despite the state's restrictive abortion laws. Molly Meegan is chief legal officer with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She says the organization is glad to see temporary relief in this case, but added that it is far from a complete solution.
The way these laws are set up in Idaho and elsewhere are that there are limits on what care can be provided. Those limits are not clearly defined, and they're not committed to the discretion, the judgment, the expertise, and the training of the physician that's facing a particular patient.
The protection for emergency abortions stems from a federal law known as the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. The law requires Medicare-funded hospitals to perform abortions in emergency situations. The three dissenting justices in Thursday's case called the act's ability to preempt Idaho's restrictive abortion laws, quote, plainly unsound. Dr. Stella Dantas is president of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Dantas says there's still a lack of clarity around the law in Idaho, and OBGYNs are leaving the state as a result. She says when doctors face the prospect of jail over restrictive laws like Idaho's, it makes their job more difficult in emergency situations.
It's already hard enough to make these critical decisions in the moment. And if you're stuck on, okay, I can go down path A, but I'm not allowed to go down path B, that is very confusing for both clinicians and the patients and the shared decision making that we do.
Molly Meegan says legislators should not be determining what care is available to patients.
These questions need to be decided by science, by evidence, by the individual case in front of you. The idea that you can have black and white rules being created by people without the expertise, training, or experiencing the emergencies is really fundamentally dangerous.
That was Molly Meegan from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
Polls show a dead heat in the repeat race for the White House. The Supreme Court deals a major blow to federal agencies' ability to enforce rules, and GOP-led states clamp down on voter registration drives. With more in the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
The question is, the Supreme Court justice, radical left.
Will you shut
up,
man? Listen, who is on your list?
Muted microphones Thursday night helped prevent the persistent interruptions of 2020's debate between former President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden. With polls showing a dead heat, Biden's campaign hopes the events boosting his standing with voters now just tuning in. The fewer than one-fifth of Americans, those living in battleground states, could tip the election, and many of those have already decided. The Supreme Court says emergency abortions can take place in Idaho for the present. A majority of justices dismissed a case, leaving in effect a lower court ruling which paused the state's near-total ban. But Nina Besser-Dorley with the Institute for Women's Policy Research says the justices' failure to affirm federal law protecting the right to emergency abortion care leaves patients and doctors in limbo.
Even where bans are in place and there are exceptions, a culture of fear and litigation has created a situation where providers and hospitals are afraid to offer services.
The Supreme Court also dealt a major blow to federal agencies' ability to enforce regulations. The court ruled people accused of fraud by the Securities and Exchange Commission have the right to a jury trial rather than face an agency tribunal. But New York University law professor Melissa Murray tells MSNBC the federal courts are already overburdened.
So the SEC is going to have to pick and choose, and that means a lot of things may go unenforced, which seems to be exactly what corporate interests want.
New laws in several GOP-led states make it harder to register voters. One Kansas law threatens anyone impersonating an election official with a felony, and volunteers worry they'll be charged by mistake. In Louisiana, a new law limits how people can help others complete registration paperwork. Secretary of State Nancy Landry says that'll help prevent fraud.
I'm hoping that these bills that pass will help us to improve our ranking and be top in the nation in election integrity.
Several Florida groups, including the League of Women Voters, say changes have effectively ended in-person voter registration drives. Tennessee election officials have sent a letter to more than 14,000 registered voters asking them to prove their citizenship. State Representative John Ray Clemens says the letter threatens recipients with 2 years in jail if they vote illegally.
This isn't about allowing illegal immigrants to vote. This isn't about voter protection. This is about voter intimidation, plain and simple.
Voting rights groups are asking the Tennessee Attorney General to investigate. A new survey finds 1 in 10 citizens of voting age, particularly voters of color, can't easily find documents to prove their citizenship. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Biden administration has a proposal to raise tariffs on $18 billion worth of Chinese imports, targeting strategic sectors like semiconductors, solar panels, long storage batteries, and electric vehicles. It's open for public comment until 9 p.m. Pacific time this evening. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative has already received over 2,500 comments. Daniel Smith reports from Pennsylvania.
Today is the last day for Pennsylvanians to submit feedback to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative about a Biden administration proposal to increase tariffs on $18 billion worth of imports from China. Pennsylvania manufacturers account for nearly 13% of the state's total output and employ almost 10% of the workforce. Arthur Stamoulis with the Trade Justice Education Fund says the tariff plan would safeguard better paying manufacturing jobs in Pennsylvania and nationwide from unfair import competition.
The type of imports that are being targeted are all too often made with sweatshop labor and even forced labor, and the tariffs are needed for U.S. manufacturers to be able to compete on a level playing field. So this is going to be good for jobs in Pennsylvania and well beyond Pennsylvania.
Stamoulis notes the Biden administration's proposal to increase tariffs on the semiconductors, renewable energy, and automotive sectors has garnered over 2,500 comments. He adds these tariffs aim to boost the number of producers and prevent monopolies, particularly in industries dominated by China. However, critics warn they could provoke retaliatory measures and harm international trade relations. Stamoulis says the combination of tariffs and investments from the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act has significantly reshaped America's manufacturing landscape and has led to a manufacturing boom in Pennsylvania and around the country.
There were more new factories built in the U.S. in 2023 than at any point in the last three decades. And these tariffs are going to help protect that investment. They're designed to prevent unfair imports overseas from undercutting the production of goods made under fair conditions here at home.
Stamoulis says the Office of U.S. Trade Representative will review the comments and make a final decision about whether, when, and how to impose these new tariffs. He adds his group hopes the administrative plan moves forward. I'm Danielle Smith, Keystone State News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 28th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moss. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Danielle Smith, and Jeremiah Hayden.